Welcome to the Astro Guy Podcast. I'm not an expert. I'm an amateur like you. I'm here to learn and here to teach. So let's enjoy the ride together. Carpe Noctem. Seize the night.
Welcome to the Astro Guy Podcast. I'm your host, Wayne Zuhl. In this episode, I had the real pleasure of interviewing a very dynamic young man, Zane Landers. In this episode, he discusses how he got interested in astronomy, his foray into telescope making, and sidewalk astronomy. It's a great episode, so sit back and enjoy. Okay, it's my pleasure this evening to welcome Zane Landers to the Astro Guy Podcast. I kind of know Zane through Facebook. We have a lot of common friends and certainly a lot of common interests. And look, Zane, you're the youngest person that I've had on the podcast, so that's kind of cool. Can you tell me a little bit? I know you're in college. Are you in your first year? Is that correct?
I'm a senior at the University of Connecticut. I'm about to graduate this spring.
Oh, wow. But are you in Connecticut or you're in Arizona?
I'm in Arizona. I'm finishing up school online and with a transfer course here in Tucson.
Very cool. Tucson's beautiful and a lot better skies than Connecticut.
Yep, just really hot. It's 85 degrees in my house, actually. It's just, you get used to it. They're like, oh, it's a dry heat, you get used to it. I was like, I don't know about that. But it's about 100 out right now, and it's 80, the thermostat says it's 84 in the house. And honestly, I feel great. I have the fan running, but it's really not that bad. It is not like 85 back home. 85 back home is horrible.
Okay.
You don't want to do anything.
So, wow, you're a senior and you're 19. Is that correct? Wow.
Yep.
All right. So, you're clearly a very intelligent young man.
I try.
And what are you majoring in school?
Communications.
Wow. All right. So what's your
history?
Okay. Do you have a career aspiration?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. So I've always been wanting to do, I always wanted to be an astronomer or an astronaut when I was little. And then I found out that I would never physically qualify to be an astronaut. And then being a professional astronomer was a lot of like sitting at a desk and looking at little pixels and PDF, more often PDF files than pixels. And I realized that's really not for me. And a lot of people, when I was in high school mainly, were always telling me how good a writer I was. And I started writing like reviews and guides for all sorts of astronomy stuff. And so it sort of ended up that I decided I want to do science communications. To get people interested in astronomy and space exploration, because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if you have the best and brightest people. I'm going to fix my points here. If you have the best and brightest people working on, on things in the astronomy world and on space exploration and on engineering, if the public is apathetic and doesn't want to fund it or doesn't know it exists or thinks it's overfunded or whatever, it really doesn't matter what good of a job you're doing if you don't get people interested and give them a reason to care. Also, in addition to funding it, want to have a career in those fields so that there's a next generation of people willing to take up these difficult jobs. And funny, I'm saying this all as I actually, I'm going to be doing an apprenticeship over the summer at an optics manufacturing company here in Tucson. It's very possible I end up making mirrors for a living. But honestly, I don't really know. But I definitely am going to continue to do science communications, regardless of what I do professionally. To me, it really is more of I will happily do astronomy outreach if I'm not paid. But if I can get paid to do it, that's even better, which is what I'm trying to do right now. And currently, I'm also an intern at NSF's NORLAB. I'm about halfway through that. And I write press releases. I haven't gotten to do any of the Instagram posts yet, but I'm going to probably get to do that soon. But a lot of stuff involving public engagement. NORLAB runs Kitt Peak, Gemini Observatory, SOAR, Cerro Tololo, and we'll be running the Vera C. Rubin Observatory. And they also have some amount of work on a lot of other collaborative projects. I think that there's some involvement in James Webb, for instance, as well.
That's really cool. and to kind of have that path kind of laid out before you and have a direction to go at your age is really amazing. And I wish I had that kind of drive and determination when I was your age. So how did you get interested in astronomy?
I vaguely remember reading a lot of books about space and stuff as a little kid. And I think when I was like 7 or 8, somebody bought me a 70 millimeter refractor. Actually, the scope itself wasn't that bad, but it came with 4 black pieces and no instructions. I had no idea how to use it. I was an 8-year-old. So we started, and I think I broke it. So I gave up. I did get it working later and tried it for a bit and it wasn't terrible. But, and then I started playing, a lot of trading card games, and that led me into meeting some people who, this guy who was into this game called Kerbal Space Program, which my brother also happened to take a very brief interest in. It's this game where you build rockets and it has accurate-ish physics simulations and whatnot. I mean, NASA scientists play it, people at JPL love it. It's a really fun game. And so I met this guy while playing this trading card game, Magic the Gathering. I think this time I met him, and he suggested I go and watch the upcoming Orion EFT-1 mission, and then also that there was a lunar eclipse coming up. The lunar eclipse was a bit later, but then the same guy was like, "Oh, there's a lunar eclipse coming up. You should go watch that." And I saw the lunar eclipse, and then I decided, "Well, I need a telescope, and I need one better than the piece of junk sitting in the basement. That's no good." So I got a little 4-inch Mac Cassegrain from Celestron, and I did a lot of research and somehow concluded that was a good beginner scope. And I mean, you can do worse. It had great optics, but it was tiny and couldn't show me anything, especially from my backyard, 45 minutes from New York City. And that sort of got me into learning about light pollution and all that. But I also, then I decided I wanted a bigger telescope. So I was like, okay, I'm going to make one. That didn't work out because my dad doesn't know a lot about woodworking or anything. And I tried to have him help me. And so I kind of put that on the back burner and I fixed up a couple of old scopes. I got a 6-inch Newtonian that was pretty good from Edmund Scientific and an 8-inch Meade Schmidt Cassegrain. And that was pretty bad optically. But, and then after I did all that, I was like, okay, well, if fixing scopes isn't that hard, well, maybe I can make one now that I know how to fix them. So I went and tried to grind a 6-inch F8 mirror and then I chipped that. I gave that to my friend who he's just finishing the scope around it now, 5 years later. I didn't give him the mirror blank until a couple of years ago, but he turned that into an F5 and he beveled out the chip. And this guy, Dave Grosky, gave me a 6-inch blank at Stealthane, and I finished that into a 6-inch F4, and it's pretty good. It's sitting in a shoebox behind me somewhere. The scope came apart, but I built that, and the optics turned out really good, and then I decided, okay, well, I need a bigger telescope. And then I tried to grind a 12-inch. And then before I could even start grinding the 12-inch, somebody plopped a 16-inch half-finished mirror in my lap. And I tried to parabolize and figure that. The thing with the 16-inch that I didn't understand was it was a 1-inch thick porthole. And I did not understand the concept of supporting it during polishing. So I ended up polishing in some astigmatism. In retrospect, it actually could have been a lot worse. It was about a wave of astigmatism. It would have, but I tried it and I was really unhappy, but I didn't know what to do. So I traded it to another guy for a finished 16-inch mirror, and that was a nice mirror. And it, I think that mirror might have been made by John Dobson. I'm not really sure. I sold it on eBay. I made a lot of dumb mistakes early on, and that was one. It turned up on eBay a year ago, and I was like, did I buy that? And I went, nah. So that was pretty good. And the structure was really janky and horrible. And so then I built a couple more scopes. I built a 10-inch that was pretty bad and a 20-inch that the mirror just wasn't done on that. But the 20-inch got me involved with this group called the Oregon Scope Works. It's run by these guys, Mel Bartels, Howard Bannock, and a couple other people. And they're part of this larger group called the Alt-As Initiative. That part's sort of on the back burner these days. It's a long story. But because I silvered the mirror for the 20-inch, I followed their spray silvering instructions. And they were like, hey, do you want to come out to our thing in Oregon in August? And I was like, yeah, I'd like to do that. And that got me into these super fast and low-cost instruments, which is what my 14.7-inch that I built kind of is. I didn't make the mirror for that, but the idea was And so now I'm sort of trying to push the idea of these super fast, lightweight telescopes with these really thin meniscus mirrors. I'm trying to, you know, bring the accessibility of both making the telescope and the actual telescope itself to a much larger audience. So the right now I'm working on a 20-inch f3.3, and that's going to have instructions and a whole list of things you need to buy and guides, and also the most crucial part, detailed instructions on how to parabolize a thin meniscus mirror, because there's not really a great condensed source of that. Like Melbar Tells has a lot, but it's not really written as a guide so much as a, well, here's how I did it. Not to knock it, but there need to be some basic instructions from the get-go. But the idea is the whole 20-inch telescope is going to be about 40 to 50 pounds. I would say under 40, but I'm honestly not confident enough in that, but it's still going to be under 50 pounds. My 14.7 inch is 58, and it's kind of beefy for what it is. And it, the telescope's going to be about 40 to 50 pounds and fit in the back of my girlfriend's Miata. It doesn't need to fit in the back of the Miata, but it's more of a point to make than anything else. And the whole cost of the telescope is only about $1,200. Wow. Now, you need to equip it with eyepieces and a coma corrector. But even if you do all that, you're still looking at spending under $2,000 to build and equip this entire 20-inch telescope, which when a typical 20-inch Obsession is no longer made and was $20,000, and Sign from Neumann or Teeter is even more. And right. Even the cheap Hubble Optics or Explore Scientific scopes, which don't know if I'd really recommend, those are, you're looking at $10,000+ for a 20-inch. That's not affordable. And even if you get a good deal on a used mirror, most people are spending easily $5,000 or more dollars on building a telescope of that size. And often if you're spending on the low end, you're getting a big slow mirror that's thick and the whole scope's big, and then it becomes even more cumbersome. So to be able to have an ultra transportable and lightweight scope that's also really cheap. And it also uses foam core composites that you can cut out most of the structure with a coping saw or a good craft knife. My hope is it'll really bring down the cost barrier of large aperture scopes to a lot of people. And you can slightly shrink the design. You can do a 14 or 16 or 18 inch. Below 14 inches, the scope's getting too short at F3. It needs a table, but but the idea is that you can make a scope like this for a lot less than the traditional thing. The main thing is the difficulty of making the big mirrors is something that and that's kind of why I haven't made any mirrors in a while. I've only made a couple of good ones. So if I can make a good 20 inch and not completely fail at it, I think that pretty much anybody can make a good 20 inch mirror as their first or second mirror. Because at this point, I've done a couple of 6-inchers that were good, and one 10 inch, and then another 10 inch that I broke, and the bad 16 inch, and that's about it. So if I can make a good 20 inch, I think that bodes well for regular people who don't have as much experience.
Having made some mirrors myself, I know what it's like, and I know the pain of not having it come out the way you want. And,
yeah.
And it's a very steep learning curve. Mm-hmm. And my first mirror took me 20 years to complete. So, and that was only an 8-inch F5. And I have a 10-inch F6, but that's still not done. And I've been working on that one for almost 20 years too. So I guess that's my pace, is every 20 years I do a mirror.
But, yeah, I taught a guy mirror making. He had started on a 6-inch F8 in 1968, and I helped him bring it down to F4, and he finished and parabolized it. I taught a little miniature class that he was in. But yeah, I think the number one thing is, you know, today you can ask questions online. There's easier ways to test mirrors. But I think the main piece of the puzzle that's missing is sort of a more updated set of techniques and instructions, the way that like John Textor's book talks about, but for the modern era of bigger and thinner mirrors. So that's what one of the things I'm hoping to try to have. And on the lower end, I have a friend who's worked on this 3D printed 4.5-inch telescope that he calls Hadley. It uses the 4.5-inch F8 optics that you can get out of like any old Japanese scope or like a Power Seeker 114, or like the optics from those department store scopes are pretty good. And you could also order the optics from AliExpress for $25 and then build the whole scope with just a 3D printer and knock together some kind of mount for it out of some wood or whatever, and spend about $90, which that's cheaper than a 4-inch telescope ever was to buy. And it's much cheaper than it is now. Now for a 4.5-inch, you're looking at $200. So to be able to build one yourself and build it for half that. And the great thing is with the optics being from a scope you could scavenge or get from AliExpress, is someone in like Nigeria or someone in Kuwait or in India who might not be able to get supplies even to make mirrors necessarily, or might not be able to get finished optics at larger sizes or get all of the necessary components, can print one of these scopes for not a whole lot of money. And 3D printing filament is pretty consistent in cost no matter where you are. And the structure, the non-printed parts that aren't the optics are pretty standard as well. You could find them at almost, and you could find or scavenge them from almost anything.
Now, I know you really enjoy, you've built several telescopes. You certainly enjoy making them. And I believe that you've also done quite a bit of scavenging, and I don't mean that in a negative way.
Oh yeah.
But you've done a lot of trading, you know, buying stuff and then trading up. And I know I've seen, I believe I've seen a lot of your stuff on Cloudy Nights that you were selling.
Cloudy Nights decided that, I don't want to be too harsh on them because somebody from there might see this, but they had this policy. They had for a while, they had all these people who were, what happened was there were these people who were selling 3D printed knickknacks as astronomy accessories in the classifieds. And then they started tagging those. They started basically tagging those people as vendors automatically, even if they were only selling a handful of things, which that's fine. They were printing, mass producing stuff to sell. Makes sense. But then what would happen was these printing people, they had so many knickknacks to sell that they would post 5 ads for their knickknacks every day in the classifieds. So what was happening was the classifieds were getting clogged up by all this 3D printed like cable holders and polar scope adapters and Badenoch masks and stuff. And the classifieds were getting clogged with that stuff. So they then decided to, so that they asked the printing people to stop that. And the printing people were like, no, because all the other vendors, they can occasionally, they do this too. And I mean, they didn't. So then what they did was they banned all vendors from selling in the classifieds period.
Right.
And then what the printers would do was they'd be like, but I'm not a vendor. And so then they just started saying, anyone who sells in high volume, and by high volume, like literally like more than like 2 ads a week, they just started considering a vendor. I know this guy, I think his name's Tom. He had a similar thing to what I'm doing. I mean, he had an eBay store too, but similarly small amount of operation. And he was just selling stuff. You know, he sometimes would have weeks of nothing, and then occasionally he'd be selling stuff in the classifieds, and they banned him from selling. And the other thing that they do to you on Cloudy Nights, if you're a vendor, as they've tagged me now, is they're very harsh on what you can say and not say about products from companies and whatnot. Wow. So they've really kind of driven, I feel a little bit driven out of there personally. And I know a lot of people who have just completely quit posting there, and it's unfortunate. Because I understand why they had to do what they did, but unfortunately, it's come at the expense of a lot of people who were not 3D printing knickknacks and clogging the classifieds and just being intentionally obnoxious.
I was going to say that's a shame because Cloudy Nights is one of my favorite resources.
Yeah,
it's a great place to get answers and insight if you have questions and. You know, and I've sold plenty of things on there. My rule is I don't spend new money on anything.
Me too.
So, you know, if I want something new, I sell something old.
And, yeah, that's kind of how I am. And for me, my other thing is I don't, you know, the thing they also kind of have said, and again, I'm not going personally against the administration. Like, I understand why they had to do what they did, because if they didn't, if they made exceptions to the rules, then the printer people would get all, you know, the printer people would be all up in arms. And so I understand. Of course, now the printer people have been driven out of business because of all this, which is kind of ironic. They kind of did themselves in. But for me, it's always been, I just like tinkering with stuff. So what I do is most of the time I go on Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace and on eBay, and I buy scopes that are usually damaged or broken in some fashion, and I fix them. That's the majority of this. The majority of the things I sell either were stuff that came with other stuff, or it's stuff that was broken and I repaired. One of my, like, I've actually done complete restorations of a few older scopes down to the paint and everything. I've had like a lot of, I've had like 30 something Celestron C8s, and probably 90% of them had something wrong with them, which was why I got them for the prices I did, like bugs inside of them. There was one I got, the first one I had, the secondary baffle wasn't tightened and the secondary would just spin. One time, one of my favorite scopes I ever had, I sold it because it just was impractical, but I had a C11 that had a broken corrector plate. This guy, Steve, really nice guy. Thank you, Steve. He's using the scope now. He had this C11 and it fell off. It fell and he broke the corrector and he offered it to me for the cost of shipping. And I just thought, well, there's a few parts attached to it maybe I could use. And then somebody else came along and said, I'll give you a corrector plate for $100. And they're like, and everyone's like, oh, you can't do that. They're matched optics. You can't just replace the corrector. And even if you did, you'd have to center it and all that perfectly. You're never going to be able to do that. That's stupid. But for $100, I was willing to find out. And so I did that and I put the scope back together, and it's one of the only telescopes that show me the Encke division in Saturn's rings. And then I sold it back to Steve and he's using it now for astronomy outreach at schools. But that's most of what my selling stuff kind of is just things that I encounter, or that like I repair. There have been scopes I've sold that were completely Frankenstein from parts from other scopes. And of course, I buy stuff a lot of the time and then I don't like it and I move on. Or I try to get people involved in the hobby, and I buy them gear and they don't want it. And then I have to get rid of it. But that's, it's not just like a lot of people think it's, oh, you're just a flipper. It's like, nah, it's entertainment, honestly. I love, it's pretty fun. You go, you go on Craigslist and you're like, oh, there's this scope 40 miles away in this town I've never been to. Why don't I take a trip and go get that, and then I'll go and get dinner in some random restaurant there. And, I would say it's almost a hobby in and of itself.
Well, let's talk about your observing, because you have all these telescopes. And before we get to the sidewalk astronomy, because I want to save that to talk about in a little bit, but just as an observer, what do you like to observe? Do you have a specific, type of object or a specific object that you always like to look at?
I really like, there are two things I really like. I like galaxies, which is why I'm always pushing towards larger apertures and why I'm really bummed that, I have a 32 inch I can go use, but it's not the same. I'm really bummed my largest scope right now is my 14.7, but my 24 inch was impractical and had to go. So, but I really like galaxies, mostly because there's just so many of them. And with a bigger scope, you start finding, you can view galaxy clusters and, the Coma B cluster, I think, is one of my favorite objects. It's in Coma, Berenices. And there's about 85 to 140 galaxies visible with a single field of view, depending on the scope and conditions. With my 14.7 inch, I counted about 60. With the 32 inch, I know it was more than 60. And of course, with the 32, you could actually move around and they didn't all fit. But the other thing that I really like are faint nebulae called integrated flux nebulae, which is sort of what these really fast scopes are partly for. I didn't really believe they were completely real or observable for a while. Mel Bartels has all these sketches of them, and the only one I ever observed was the little one around Andromeda, this little thing next to the Andromeda galaxy. And then when I got here to Tucson, I saw a few of them with the 14.7. The main one I saw was the bubble around the Pleiades, which is in fact a real object. Then with the six, I built this 6-inch F3. That's the peak of scavenging. There was, I got a 6-inch F8 scope with a fiberglass tube. A friend wanted to make a scope. I gave her the optics for it. I kept the mirror zone tube. The tube was really ugly and damaged, so I chopped it down. And I had a 6-inch F3 mirror that I had bought that was made in 1947, 46, and really nice. I bought a new focuser and a new secondary and cut down the tube and wrapped the tube in vinyl. It's now a great little wide field scope, but I actually use it by putting it in my lap. I didn't have a, I just moved into my house, so I didn't have anywhere to do any building. So this, I don't have a mount for it. So the scope, you just sit in your lap and look through it like a big Astro scan. And with that thing, you can actually see there's integrated flux nebulae everywhere. There's known as galactic cirrus. It's really faint gas in the Milky Way that starlight reflects off of. And there's a big, the bubble around the Pleiades is way bigger than I thought. There's a integrated flux nebulae around Betelgeuse. I don't know if it's related to Betelgeuse or not, but it's there. There's a bunch of stuff in Canis Major and Canis Minor and over in Auriga, and it's really cool. And the dark nebula and dark nebulae as well. I don't observe really methodically. That's something I tried doing. I did the Herschel 400, but I was going to do the Herschel 2 for a while, and I sort of stopped. At this point, I've probably done a lot of them by accident, but I sort of just, you know, I'll pick out a few like new, my thing is I kind of just look around the sky with the Richfield scopes. You just pan them around with the 32 inches a little more. I have a friend of the 32 inch Tektron. With the 32, you have to be a little more methodical because you have to at least pick out stuff that's in the same vicinity. So you don't have to move the entire scope and ladder constantly. But generally it's like, I look at my favorite old stuff and I might try a different eyepiece or a different observing technique. That's like, I know. And then I try to at least observe like two or three completely new targets of some sort every time I go out to do proper observing. And sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. It also really depends on the conditions and the scope. For example, with the 32 inch, last time I was at my friend's house with the 32, he lives in these beautiful SQM 21.8 or 21.9 Portal 2 skies, and he has this 32 inch Tektron, and we just roll it out. The mechanics of the scope kind of suck, but the optics are amazing. It won't reach focus with my coma corrector, unfortunately, and the focal length's very long. But we looked at the seeing happened to be good, so we looked at planetary nebulae, and we looked at a few of them that he had never seen and I had never seen, and they were all blue and green, and there's this red and gold one in Lepus that's really cool. And then we decided to, for giggles, point the scope as like near the horizon to look at Omega Centauri, and the stars were bloated, but it looked pretty cool. But that's sort of my observing is just, you know, it's supposed to be a hobby. It's supposed to be fun. And when I started doing the Herschel 400, it was initially kind of a way to challenge myself under the really bad skies I was stuck under. I was stuck in a portal 6, 5, 4 areas for most of my astronomy career. And that was, you know, and that was fun. Like I observed some of the Herschel 400 globulars that with a 3-inch Takahashi from my backyard because I thought it would be cool. But after a while, it kind of turned into feeling like work. By the time I was done with it, I was really kind of done with the whole observing list thing. So now I've kind of just gone back to, you know, hey, like, I'm going to just look at some random targets and I'll pick some new ones. And, you know, like, what are the limits of this scope? What are some interesting things right now? What's the seeing going to allow me to do? You know, contrary to popular belief, Arizona does not have the greatest seeing all the time. We have nights when the seeing's really good. We have nights when the seeing's really good and then goes really bad. And we have nights when the seeing is really bad and it's also blustery winds. So you really can't, on some nights, we can't use the 32 because the 32 will spin like a weather vane. That's part of why I love the faster scopes is they don't tend to do that. There's not as much of a moment arm.
So have you ever done or gotten into astrophotography at all?
Yeah, I did. I put together a complete setup with my Takahashi 3-inch that I had and HEK 5 and my DSLR and set up in my backyard. I had it running on Nina, and I would actually boot the setup up, choose a target, and go to sleep. And I did that 3 or 4 times and decided it was the most boring thing in the world. I had several thousand dollars sunk in the setup and, you know, all this to be among thousands of other people who posted equal, if not better, photos to Instagram and AstroBin and who are more inclined to go. The thing on Instagram essentially is like people are like, I spent 16 hours out in the cold and dark capturing the faint white from this galaxy. And it's like, no, you didn't. I mean, if you did, that's kind of dumb because if you knew what you were doing, you could easily just set up an image capture software and that most people do. And then they just lie and act like they did something. But, you know, the reality is the life of the 2022 astrophotographer is debugging, and then getting the scope pointed at the target and going to sleep or watching Netflix.
That's about right. That's about right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I enjoy it, but I've been a visual observer for most of my life. I started when I was very young as well. I was like 7 when I first got into the hobby, and I was always a visual observer. And I did a little astrophotography probably 20, 30 years ago. And then it just got so expensive and difficult to do. And I got away from it, especially when the digital DSLR started coming out. They were very expensive in the beginning.
Yeah.
But now, with the CMOS cameras and everything else and things like the ASI Air, it becomes really easy.
Yeah.
I actually want to start doing some EAA so I can do some outreach with it. But I think for that reason, it's very good. But
with the photography thing, we're getting to the point now where there are literal just push button telescopes that you can go and buy, and they'll do everything for you. And I guess my question is, with that has always been, for me, it's always been two things. For one, I've never lived somewhere where I could really just have great skies in my backyard. So I could set up an imaging rig in my yard here, but it's stupid to set up an imaging rig in a Bortle 6 when a Bortle 3 is 30 minutes away. But also, if I drive somewhere, then I have to put together this whole rig every time I use it, and then either sit there or set up my visual scope on top of that. And that's just not appealing, and the expense wasn't worth it. And my question with the automation stuff too is, we're getting to the point now where it's becoming so easy. I mean, there are now AI tools that can do your processing in large part. That's really the final frontier. We're getting to the point where it's so easy that astrophotography becomes less of a passion project and more of a sizing up of who has the largest credit card bill at the end of the month. And at the end of the day, you can do a really good job with an ED80 and an HEQ5, and somebody else has access to a plane wave and they'll beat you. And also, if you're on the low end of things too, everybody on the low end of gear has the same gear. Everybody's got a T3i and a Red Cat, or an ASI 1600 and ED80 and an HEQ5 or VX. So the photos don't end up even being that different, because most of the gear is all coming from the same handfuls of places. And the ideal setup that's optimized is usually the same stuff. So there's sort of this, I guess the way I would describe it is, everything sort of trends towards the mean, and it's hard to differentiate yourself. And I think if you want to view astrophotography as an art form, then differentiating yourself is important. And I think that's hard to do. On the EAA end of things, I've always had a huge problem with EAA, because I think it doesn't replace an eyepiece. And I think if you're for outreach, it's bothered me because people are like, well, those youngsters, they got to look at screens. All they do is look at screens. It's like, maybe instead of shoving another screen into their life that they'll quickly forget. Like someone was saying, oh yeah, someone took a photo of my EAA rig and posted their Snapchat story. Yeah, because it took them no effort to do that. It doesn't mean anything that you engage them. But rather than getting one more screen in everybody's life that they're going to forget among the myriad of screens and digital experiences they have every hour, maybe give them something analog that they'll remember, and also maybe drag them away from the screens that you complain about constantly. And the other issue I have too is, when you're doing outreach, people are committing their time to come and see something in the night sky. And if you're having them commit their time and effort and interest, and they're looking at something that they could just look at on their phones and not have to actually be there or have a telescope, I really question that. But the worst to me is when there's people who tell me like, why do you even use an eyepiece when you could just put a camera in the scope and observe that way? And, I don't think it's the same for a lot of reasons, but it's disheartening to me that people think that is some kind of replacement. I'm one of those people who's really kind of horrified by all this like metaverse stuff. And to me, I don't want astrophotography and astronomy to just be another metaverse type thing where it's like, oh, everything's everything's on screens or augmented reality, like stuff for the night sky too. It's like, it's great if you're using it as a finder chart, but if you're staring up at the night sky at your bright phone, which then makes you unable to see all the stars, I feel like that's kind of ruining the point. It's emphasized when you see like the advertising for like the Unistellar EV scope, which I hate that thing. They're like, they have it set up like next to a campfire or at their dinner party or whatever. And then they're all looking down at their tablet instead of up at the sky. And it's like, why are we doing, like at that point, why bother? Right. I mean, it's a question of why bother even if it was free, but when it's, when this stuff is, this gear is expensive. And even if it's only like $1,000 and not $5,000, it's still a question of like, what are you really doing? Because you're not seeing, you know, if I go at, let's say I wanted to, you know, I want to see a capybara. Okay, well, I can go on YouTube and watch videos of capybaras all day long, but that doesn't replace going to the zoo, or even better, actually going to South America and seeing a capybara. It's not the same. You know, if you want to see the Grand Canyon, you don't say, I saw the Grand Canyon by going on Google Earth and looking at the Grand Canyon.
Right.
And that's what the night sky is. That's what the universe is. Because, you know, we could say that about going to the moon too. I mean, we could just say, okay, well, we're only going to look at the moon forever. Why go there? We can just look at it. We can just look at it or look at maps of it or try to do radar mapping of it from orbit. And we could figure out what the surface looks like that way. But why don't you actually send anybody there? Why would you land there? That's, you don't need to do that. You know, we could just look at a digital representation of it. It's the same thing. It's just that, you know, you say that to somebody and they're like, oh no, I wouldn't do that. But someone was just telling me today, they were like, they tried to get someone to look at the transit of Mercury. And the guy was like, nah, I'll see it later on the news. And it's like, no, you won't. You'll see a picture of it that you'll probably forget about because it was just another brief image on a screen when life is now a bunch of brief images on screens, you know. I think that's sad. And also the a lot of the EAA people I've met seem to basically say, oh, well, light pollution's already so bad and gonna get so bad that you just won't be able to see any stars anyway. So we might as well just embrace the digital stuff now. And it's like, no. Like light pollution, anti-light pollution advocacy is getting better than ever. And people are genuinely learning about the health effects and all that. Don't just give up. That's not a, you know, so I understand in certain cases, like there was a guy, like I was on a thread, and this guy was like, oh, you know, I had these like cancer patients who were in wheelchairs and I showed them a thing on EAA and they were in tears and they loved it. And like, that's fine. They weren't going to be able to look through a regular scope or go somewhere that they could get to see the night sky. But when you're going and doing a star party at a venue where the Milky Way is visible overhead, and then you don't tell the venue to turn off the lights because you have a television set with a blurry pixelated photo of the Orion Nebula on it. Like, really? Why even polar align the scope? You could just have a static image and people wouldn't know.
Right. Yeah, it's a very interesting take on it. And, you know, I know personally for me, I love visual observing. I love astrophotography as well. But, and like you, I really enjoy the faint fuzzies, you know, the things that are difficult to see. So, you know, and I live in a Bortle, you know, 7.8 zone. I'm only 17 miles from New York City. So, I'm kind of stuck. If I want to see anything visually from my house, I need to really, you know, break out the best tools that are available to do that. At least the best tools I have access to. But I know my way around the sky. I can go outside and I can look and I can point out constellations and tell you what that star is. And a lot of people doing astrophotography today in EAA, and it's not a slam against them, but
they don't
know. And, you know, a lot of times you see things and it doesn't bother me, but I know people that like they get upset because somebody will post something somewhere And it's just a blank star field. And I said, you know, I was trying to find M42 and this is what I got. And, you know, they're nowhere near
M42.
In the sky. Yeah.
That's just inexcusable.
Of course.
M42, I draw a line at that. If you can't find M42, what are you even doing?
Right.
But that's why I know it. I've seen it. But, you know, it's amazing to me. I've met astrophotographers who are like, you're the visual guy. You know where everything is. Do you have any suggestions for like a good target in this area? And I'm like, dude, just like get your phone out and look at Sky Safari. I mean, really, it's not even like you have to consult a chart or anything. You'd think that the guys who are doing all this digital stuff would know about the phone apps. And then they're like, where's the Big Dipper?
Well, that's why I'm a big advocate of learning, you know, going out and doing things, really learning the sky the old fashioned way. And I think it's really important. I did an interview with Steve Dodson a couple months ago. And we talked about, and Steve and I go back a very long way, but
I've met him a few times. He's very nice.
Yeah, he's a terrific guy. But,
right?
You know, we talked about using a planisphere to learn, and how to use it. And just using a planisphere and a pair of binoculars in your eyes, just to get out there and learn the sky. And then, if you want to get into some more advanced things, that's fine. The hobby is big enough that, you can find the area that you like. But it's interesting. And I really think it's just technology that people who don't know anything about astronomy or the sky at all are going out and, they like the technology. So they're getting into it. And that's fine. If that's what you want to do, that's fine. But we're getting a little off topic here.
Yeah.
Do you have other science interests besides astronomy?
Well, I have like a lot of friends who are engineers and stuff and work at aerospace companies. And of course, I'm nutty about space exploration. I saw the Falcon Heavy demo in 2018. I'm thinking about going to Florida to see Artemis 1 at this point, because now the launch is probably going to be in July and I might actually be able to make it out there for that. Of course, it's Florida in July. But, I'll suffer for it. Why not? I could. Boca Chica is like just far enough that driving to it seems kind of nuts. But part of me wants to drive to it because, there you can actually because then I can like bring like a nice camera and all that. I could bring a scope and track the launch with the telescope,
Right.
But I'd like to see it. I mean, my hope is that Starbase doesn't get abandoned. They can, they do Starship launches out there. And they can catch one eventually. I'd love to see like a tower catch or something. But I'm pretty involved. Like, I have like moderate interest in like geology and marine biology and all that. I know a lot about history and classical studies and military history and stuff. I sort of just end up reading about a lot of topics from bouncing from one thing to the next online or read books. And that sort of influenced a lot of my views on astronomy and science and space exploration in general. I will say, as much as I don't really like the people who are just mindlessly buying astrophotography gear, they are driving down the prices for the rest of us for astronomy gear, because it's supply and demand, They're buying more of it. They're making more of it. The cost per unit's going down. That's good. So I'll always thank them for that at the very least. But I was almost an economics major. The thing, it all of it sort of has drawn me back to science, communications, and astronomy in a way. It's hard to really explain, but I've sort of just, every time I've read about something like war history or about, something in ancient Greece, it always just ties back to this whole idea of perspective and how much people lack it now, and sort of part of why I love astronomy so much is it is the ultimate sense of perspective, really. And a lot of that knowledge has sort of influenced like my attitude towards my attitude towards all of this, and sometimes been informative when it comes to coming up with ideas. My girlfriend is a big car person, and she came up with the idea of wrapping a couple of telescopes in vinyl. And so she has this big purple XT12i that we wrapped, and we bring it out for cyber astronomy. And people love that because it's people, you see it from half a mile away walking down the street. There's this 5 foot tall purple tube, and everyone, you know, wants to wonder what the hell the giant purple tube is. And so that's sort of, I try to be very interdisciplinary when it comes to my interests and hobbies. I think that not everything, like, as much as it's great to categorize things, I think information about one subject can translate to the other a lot of the time in some way that you might not think of. And I think a lot of people are very rigid in their thinking and don't like to do that, even when it can be really beneficial. And I think that's kind of a bummer. I think somebody summed it up to me as, you know, science and innovation aren't a linear path from point A to point B. It's, you have a point A and you have a point B, but you end up at point C, and point C was probably better than point B anyways. That's how it's been with building telescopes. It's how it's been with my career. It's how it's been with doing sidewalk astronomy even. You know, I met my girlfriend while I had John Dobson scope set up. And I think that's really the, you know, I think that's really a good way of thinking about things. It's not necessarily the destiny. I wouldn't say it's all about the journey, but the destination isn't usually the one that you had in mind. It's usually better.
That's awesome. And I want to transition. You mentioned John Dobson. I have a sort of a family connection with John Dobson. Not me personally, but my brother's wife is John Dobson's cousin. Her first name is Lowry, and John Dobson's middle name was Lowry. It was a family name. And she met him back in the 1960s. But as you know, John's no longer with us. John, I had the pleasure of spending a lot of time with him at Stellafane. I was his driver 1 year up there, and he taught my son how to use chopsticks. So he was a really interesting guy. And you know, he bought this telescope, which you know, Dobsonians, I mean, I've built Dobsonians, and I know you've built Dobsonians. They're the most popular telescopes in the world. And he never, you know, made money off of it, but he wanted to share the hobby. And I just saw an article that was online where you were interviewed by the newspaper in Tucson about the Tucson Sidewalk Astronomers, and that's a group that you started. So let's hear about that, because that's really interesting.
I named it the Arizona Sidewalk Astronomers because TSA is a terrible acronym. I don't want to have the same acronym as the people that annoy me every time I want to fly somewhere. So also it just gives it more of a general appeal. And there aren't any other Sidewalk Astronomers in Phoenix or anything, so I felt like I could have that title. If there are, feel free to make me change my name. It's not hard. It would take me like 20 minutes.
So when did you start this organization?
Well, it's I'd say organization's a bit overkill. It's me, my girlfriend, and whatever random couple of friends I have who might be able to get out there. There's like three people. What happened was, so back a year ago, right around now, it was a little less than a year ago. It was the summer, and there was this wildfire smoke over Connecticut. And so nothing was really observable, and the moon was eventually observable, and the planets were out, but nothing besides the planets and the moon were observable. Well, we did have the planets initially. We didn't have the moon that first week, but I was with somebody, and she suggested, you know, she had watched all of these, some of the videos of John Dobson and about sidewalk astronomy. And she was like, you talk about this guy and you have all these scopes that you build, and yet you aren't copying that part. Why don't you do that? I mean, she's like, you know, I don't think we can observe it. You can observe anything else right now. Anyway, why don't you do that? I'll come with you. And so I started doing that. And, you know, I admittedly wasn't very organized. I didn't do the greatest job at advertising. I didn't bring signs, and I didn't bring a tip jar, which was stupid of me because it turns out people love that. You know, I did sidewalk astronomy a few nights a month in Connecticut for like the entirety of the summer and fall. And, you know, nobody really talked about it because in the astronomy club, the main astronomy club in Connecticut that I was in, the Westport Astronomical Society, really cool group, by the way, highly recommend them. They're building, I just got the newsletter. I think they're building more domes now at the observatory, which is really exciting. Like they would advertise it a little bit, but like, it was never really like a super organized thing. I didn't really have a plan. I didn't try to do anything to follow up to get people interested. And that was dumb of me. But I would do that. And so then I came here. So then in August of last year, I was at Stella Fane and somebody gave me John Dobson's 8-inch F6. And then I was like, well, now I have to do sidewalk astronomy with this thing. I mean, you know, so I started doing it a little bit more in the fall, but you know, I got cold and where I would set up would be a mile walk from where I could park in downtown Stanford, which is where I was setting up. So I stuck the scope on a dolly, but even then it was a pain to do all that. And so I didn't do it that much. I didn't have anyone to go with me. So, you know, it's Connecticut. We're basically New Yorkers. People are not as friendly as they are here in Arizona. Mm-hmm. So then I came here I have my internship, but other than my internship, you know, I don't go to the U of A. I don't, you know, I'm not old enough to go to a bar. So I didn't really know anybody or have anything to really, and I couldn't work on anything because I was in my apartment when I first got here. So I didn't really have anything to do in the evening other than work on my other job. And I didn't have any friends here, and I didn't have anything to do. So I was like, why don't I just go do sidewalk astronomy down at U of A? You know, I don't know anything about this place. I have no idea if there's someone who already does this. I don't know if the U of A people will kick me out. I don't know if someone will try to steal my car. I don't know anyone here. This is an idiotic idea. Why don't I just do it? So I set up, like, literally, I've been in Tucson for like 3 days, and I did that. And so it turns out, first off, that people in Tucson are really generous. And there were a lot of people dropping their kids off back from the winter break, a lot of parents. And like, people tipped me ridiculous amounts at first. I thought that was going to continue. It didn't. But, you know, I still make enough to go get myself a pizza, which is pretty good. At the very least, it was covering my parking. I didn't know about a free parking spot for a while. I found one. But after a while, so like, I set up, and I've always been trying to get people interested in setting up scopes with me and going and observing with me. And that was what I was trying to do. And I'm still trying to do. And around probably like a weekend, there was a Jesuit, a traveling Jesuit priest, and he hung out with me for a while. And he convinced me to stay out on this really windy night when I was otherwise going to go home. And then somebody from across the street started shouting something like, is that a Dobsonian? And I'm like, and then I look and I'm expecting like some like old person or something, because it didn't register me who had said it. And my now girlfriend, Farida, walks across the street and comes and looks through the scope. And then we went out to dinner right afterward, and now I'm in a house with her. So, and it turns out she had been an astronomy major at the U of A and just switched. And so we go observing and do outreach together and all that. And then a few nights later, I met a couple more of my friends. I have a couple of good friends who I met also while doing sidewalk astronomy, and they all have scopes now. And they set up with me when they can. And sort of there hasn't been a whole lot of development on formalizing anything. You know, I'm not going to go and start a nonprofit. I don't have the time or energy to do that anyway. You know, I just, and most of the time it is just me and one other person setting up. So, but the goal really is just to get people interested in astronomy and space exploration. You know, if there's somebody who's really interested and wants to learn how to make telescopes or get a telescope from me or go observing with me or whatever, that would be really great. And I wish that all the people who said that would call me back one of these days, because there's been a lot of them. There's even a guy who built his own telescope mounts, and he did on-step stuff, and I need help with on-step, but I haven't heard back from him. And So, but you know, people love it. They tip, they ask questions, they run screaming across the street to come get their friends to have a look, you know, and typically we're getting on a bad night is when you get only 100 people to look through the scope typically, but on a good night, we're getting up to 500, 600 people. And that's without advertising in advance. I've done a bit of that. It doesn't seem to have much of an effect. And you know, there's not really a lot of big goals with that. I'm hoping that, you know, I will be having the 20 inch will be set up for Sidewalk Astronomy when it's done. And you know, my hope is to maybe popularize that. But that right now, it's really just kind of, you know, hey, it's something to do. It gets it, I make a buck and can go get something out to eat. You meet people, you hear a lot of people stay and have conversations. Most of the people who stick around the longest tend to be religious, but it's always interesting to talk to them. I've had very few problems in general. Of course, when I have had problems, it's been pretty bad. It's for the most part, it's a pretty safe place, and people genuinely love it, and they come back and they invite their friends, and you have a lot of interesting conversations. And you know, it's something I really enjoy doing, and I think. You know, if it gets one more person to, you know, if you get the right person to go and they end up being, you know, the right person looks through my scope and they end up being in Congress someday. NASA's Europa Clipper mission exists because of one congressman, one guy who aggressively pushed for it for like 10 years. Now, I don't think Europa Clipper is the most, would I prefer to sell this mission? Yes, but the fact is that entire mission exists because of one guy who's really, really just kind of passionate about space, happened to be in the right place at the right time to argue for funding that mission. And, you know, it's the same thing for stuff at NASA. It's the same thing for, you know, somebody wants to become an engineer or a scientist and they go and found the next SpaceX or Blue Origin or Astra or whatever, or they go and work and develop something at NASA or, you know, or again, they're in a position where they're able to advocate for funding and public support, or they become a teacher and somebody they teach becomes the next Stephen Hawking. You know, you're not going to get that if you just sit around waiting and hoping for people to find out stuff online. Because if I had run into a John Dobson when I was like 14 and struggling to learn how to even use a scope, you know, or like find deep sky objects or make my own scope and mirror, I would have been so thrilled and so much better off. And I think there's a lot of people out there who they don't buy good telescopes, or they buy a good telescope, they have no idea how to use it. They don't know about astronomy clubs, or they find an astronomy club and the astronomy club isn't very nice to them. And then they become completely really disinterested in the entirety of the hobby. You know, that happens a lot. And that happens way more, unfortunately, I think, than the positive experiences. And then there's, of course, you know, there's so many people who they get like horrible hobby killer scopes. And then they might, you know, there could be someone down the street from them, or there could be some astronomy club that has a perfectly good scope that they'd be willing to let them borrow, but they get so frustrated that they never find out. Or they want to buy a telescope, but they have this idea in their head that a telescope's extremely expensive. And well, they are nowadays, but making one isn't. You know, now the tables have turned and it's cheaper to build an even an 8-inch dot than to buy one. But you know, they have all these conceptions in their heads, or to be an astronomer is to be a scientist in an observatory or something. You know, they have all these conceptions, and the only way you're going to, and even if you have the best run program and the best run organization in the world, if people don't know about it or they have these misconceptions about it, it doesn't really matter what you're actually doing on the inside. And if the only way people can hear about you is by Googling you or finding your page, then you know that doesn't help either. But if you shove astronomy stuff in their faces and you give them ideas, you put the thought in their heads of maybe going to an observatory or going to an astronomy club, or you put the thought in their heads of, you know, maybe, hey, you know, maybe I should take that engineering course, or maybe I should take my kid to an observatory, or maybe I should you know, something like that, or maybe I should, you know, go to this, you know, maybe I should go to this planetary society thing that's going to try to advocate for more funding for this program at NASA. You know, that can change so much with so little. And that's really the core motivation behind doing it is, you know, I'm probably not going to be the next John Dobson, but somebody else might. And even if I'm not, you know, people who John Dobson taught how to make optics worked on making CoStar to fix Hubble. They worked on people he that met him in San Francisco. They've worked at JPL. They work at the place at the optical places here in Tucson. They work at the Richard F. Karras Mirror Lab, or they did, you know, or people who work at those got into astronomy because of Dobsonians or because of astronomy outreach or whatever. And, you know, that's not going to be everybody, but there's a lot of people who it's never going to occur to otherwise to even commit the time to go to an observatory. Because here, even here, you know, you got to be out on the right night of the week that they're set up. You got to go, you know, you probably have to drive out of your way. You know, back home in Connecticut, the observatory that I went to was 15 minutes away from anything, even the highway. And it wasn't particularly dark. You could barely see the Milky Way on a good night. So, you know, you were looking at, for some people, it could be an hour of driving of commitment, even if they don't live that far away. And then they don't know what they're going to get to see. It could be cloudy. It could be, you know, they might only get to see two things if they stay there for an hour if it's crowded. So that, but if you shove it in their face and they get to see maybe even if it's just the moon or a planet, if you shove it in their face and they get to see it and they otherwise wouldn't have, for one thing, that's one more person who got to see it that otherwise wouldn't have. And for another, there's a real possibility that they're inspired to then commit the time and effort to do something else later.
That's a great outlook. And that leads me into my final question for you is what's in the future for you? What do you see as far as astronomy goes? Where's your future going to be?
Well, my hope is that with the development of this 20-inch scope, that maybe there's going to be some things that aren't replicable or don't go really well with it. But my hope is that it can inspire a new wave of really of F3 meniscus mirror instruments that people can make themselves. And on the smaller end, I'm working with my friend on stuff like the Hadley. I'm continuing to do sidewalk astronomy. My hope is, and I'm already seeing it, I'm seeing people who I know on Reddit and Discord in their cities, they might not be even in the US, they're going out and doing sidewalk astronomy and they're meeting people who then want to do it with them or who want to do it on their own somewhere else. I just talked to someone for somewhere I was applying for an internship, part-time job really, and she had read about my stuff and had decided to do sidewalk astronomy in her neighborhood as part of International Dark Sky Week. And the hope is that with the on the equipment end, with the stuff I'm working on, that if, you know, if everybody, if almost anybody can afford a 20-inch scope and fit it in their Prius, that brings visual astronomy, even in, under mediocre skies, back to a lot of people. And it brings the possibility too of, well, you know, if we're bringing the economics and everything of a 20-inch down to where it currently is for a 10-inch, well, then we're going to be able to bring a 30-inch down to where it is for a 16-inch. So the next project is going to be a 30-inch meniscus mirror scope with similar techniques, cost cap of maybe $5,000. And I mean, if you think a 20-inch is expensive, a 30-inch telescope, there aren't even price tags on. It's probably $50,000 or more to buy one new right now. They don't show up on the used market. The mirrors for them don't show up on the used market. You don't see 30-inch and larger telescopes very often, even though it's completely possible to build a 30-inch telescope that weighs 100 pounds, fits in a Prius, and is barely, and the eyepiece is barely higher than the top of your head when it's at the zenith. But most people don't even know that's possible. And if they try to pursue it, they post about it, cloudy nights, all the naysayers will say, no, you can't do that. Because there's a lot of gatekeeping, I think, in telescope making. It's kind of, I think if you make it sound like mirror making is really impossible and don't provide really good resources on how to do it, then it gives you kind of a status symbol of, oh, look at me, I made this super hard to make thing. Well, it shouldn't be hard to make, but you don't want to teach people and you don't make the stuff more accessible. So it ends up being hard, but it shouldn't be hard. Because I think anybody, you know, a 30 inch is probably going to be about $5,000. That's a, you know, it's a order of magnitude decrease in cost, same as the 20. And, you know, a lot of people can definitely afford to build a $1,200 20 inch. And a lot of people can afford a $5,000 16 inch. And if people can afford a $5,000 16 inch, then they can afford a $5,000 30 inch that folds up in the same space. And they're going to see a lot more with that 30 inch. And hey, what if those people start doing sidewalk astronomy with these 20 inch and 30 inch scopes? That would be really great. And if we're thinking 30 inch, well, physically, you could compact a 1 meter telescope to fit in a minivan. It's doable. And so I have kind of a variety. The thing with the 1 meter is it starts to get to the point where Obtaining the glass is a little more difficult for even a slump meniscus. So I have five possible sources of blanks right now for something in the 1 meter range, ranging from a guy who's willing to cast me one to a slump meniscus to a Hextech blank that's in a trailer in downtown Tucson. And at least one of those is going to end up in a scope I make. It's quite possible I end up making multiple mirrors and or scopes, because I think the meniscus mirror is, of course, the most replicable. But if I'm going to get the glass for the other ones, I might as well do something with them. And, you know, beyond that, I think, well, somebody made a 60-inch F3 slumped mirror, and it works. It ended up not being parabolized because it's for a speculum interferometry thing. But, you know, a 60-inch is going to be, that's a trailer or an observatory. That's $10,000, $20,000 of spending probably. But, hey, you know, right now, a 30-inch telescope is basically, for most people who buy one, it's tens of thousands of dollars. It's a life, even a 20-inch is considered a lifestyle choice. But for a scope of that, for like a 30-inch scope, that's usually a permanent setup in a trip and or trailer. Think of, you know, imagine if all the people who had 30-inchers right now had 60-inchers. That would be a lot of 60-inchers. And while we're at it, you know, if we can produce these things with lighter and thinner mirrors for lower cost, there's research potential here. There are a lot of universities that would really like to have a set of portable, you know, if they had $30,000 to spend and they could build a dozen portable half-meter reflectors and put some CMOS cameras on them and do, exoplanet transits or occultations with them. Occultations especially are one where a lot of portable big telescopes would be great. You know, there's some potential there. Am I going to be the one that necessarily pioneers all of that? Probably not. But there are other people working on it. And if I can get other people to be more interested in it, that would be good. But, you know, my goal is continue getting more people into doing astronomy and doing astronomy outreach and build bigger, faster, cheaper scopes. And I think if I don't have a 60-inch telescope in 10 years, I've messed up. Well, bigger than that, don't know. I think an amateur built 100 to 120-incher is something that's probably in the realm of possibility, but it requires a small group of people with the willpower and the funds to do it. Do I think that that's something I could probably end up doing? Absolutely. I really would like to, but, you know, I don't want to, I think it's good to have big aspirations, but right now there are big aspirations that precede that. But I think, you know, I think that getting more and bigger telescopes in the hands of people for less money, and then encouraging people to look through those telescopes and encouraging people who don't have telescopes to come look through them, is really kind of what it boils down to. And everything else is just a more complicated rendition of that, or a means to that end. And do I have, like, are there things I'd like to see having a direct effect on in the world of space exploration and astronomy and funding and public engagement? Yes, absolutely. But, you know, I think if I continue to put myself out there and do this stuff will happen as a result of that I can't possibly predict anyway. And I'd rather just focus on the doing and less than the hoping, because the doing has done a pretty good job so far. The hoping is just consuming time and effort that could go to more doing. So
I have to tell you, I'm very impressed by you. And I hope that there's a lot more people in the world that have your type of thinking, that are forward thinking, and that, you know, you're looking at things from a totally different perspective, especially about what the norms are. And I think that's just a fantastic thing. And I want to thank you for agreeing to come on and talk with me and spending the time with me. I really, really appreciate it.
I'm Wayne Zoll, and this was the Astro Guy Podcast. Thank you for listening. As always, your questions, comments, and suggestions are welcome. Keep wondering. Keep your eyes on the sky. Have fun. Carpe Noctem. Seize the night.